Curious Naked Diatribes. Curious Naked Diatribes. CND would like to give a warm welcome to our guest, Dr. Alex Kaznavich. Alex is a professor of sociology and anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He has authored and co-authored many books, including Frequently Asked White Questions, Making Sense of Society, The Radical Imagination, and of particular interest to our discussion today, Zapatistas and Zapatismo Beyond Borders. Alex, it's such an honor to have you on the program. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much, Jason. Thanks for the invitation to be here.
It's been 30 years since the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico. But before we get into it, I'd like to know more about this idea of collective liberation. I saw this term in one of your bios and was just delighted by it. What is collective liberation to you, and how does it figure into your work?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I'm really happy to start with that one. Yeah, collective liberation, I think, is one of the phrases that I came across in my political activism and academic research, and I just was immediately drawn to it. So I'd love to say that I coined it, but that's absolutely not true. I'm drawing on sort of a rich history of anarchism, of radical feminism, of anti-colonial struggles that have all sort of circled around this term as an idea. So the basic principle at the root of it is that nobody is really free until everyone is, and that doesn't mean obviously some utopian space of total autonomy where you get to do absolutely anything you want, but this whole idea that freedom is always relational, that, you know, I build my freedom in relation to you, and it's not just a question of negative freedom, it's this horizon towards which we're walking, where we're trying to make sure we have the ability to do as little harm to each other, either accidentally right. or intentionally as possible, but along the way, building ways of relating to one another and building institutions in our society that actually put that autonomy, that relational autonomy, you know, the right to give myself law, the right for you to rule over yourself, always relationally to the other people we occupy society with. And I just think it's sort of a fundamental liberation principle that takes us way beyond the notion of individual rights, which are always, you know, people are arguing about, oh, well, my freedom. And that's such a limited way of thinking about how we can really achieve a society that's both egalitarian, but also free and just.
Right. Well, we're going to carry this idea into the discussion of the Zapatista movement. And if you wouldn't mind just giving us a thumbnail sketch of who the Zapatistas are and also how you discovered their revolutionary movement, what got you interested enough to dedicate two books on them?
Great question. So the Zapatistas are an indigenous revolutionary movement located in the far southeast of Mexico. Their territory in rebellion constitutes around a third, maybe up to half of the state of Chiapas in the far southeast of Mexico. The Zapatistas emerged publicly on January 1st, 1994, which, you know, seems hilariously ancient history to most of my students and other young folks these days, but I remember it quite well. I think there's just several important sort of pillars to mention about the Zapatistas. I think the first one was, one of the things that makes them so important is that they emerged at a moment when, for folks, again, who maybe don't remember that time so well or perhaps weren't born yet, the Soviet Union had just collapsed, the Berlin Wall had come down. In many ways, like a great moment, obviously, because state-sponsored communism was not the liberatory horizon that most people were hoping for. But on the other hand, a moment of real great disaffection and disappointment on the part of people who were hoping for something other than unfettered global capitalism and all its trappings. And so it was kind of a dark time because, you know, for all of its gross imperfections, at least the USSR represented something of a like a counterbalance or an alternative to that sort of just, you know, the global domination of capitalism. And so when the Zapatistas emerged on January 1st, 1994, out of the jungles and canyons of Chiapas, they marched out of these territories, seized several cities, municipalities, towns in the far southeast, and declared immediately that they weren't at war with Mexican people, that their aim was not to seize power and tell everybody else how they had to live, but that they were rising up in arms because they had been given no choice, that it was either die on their knees, essentially, or live on their feet, and that this this war that they initiated, very clearly directed against the Mexican presidency and with the aim of overcoming the army and marching on Mexico City so that Mexicans could freely and democratically govern themselves and rearrange their society. That was, I think it's hard now in the aftermath of Occupy and Black Lives Matter and Idle No More and all the movements we've seen since, really, including the alter-globalization struggles of the early 2000s. People are like, oh yeah, I get that now. Like I get, we kind of hear this rhetoric. But at the time, it was really, it was new. It did not follow the kind of revolutionary propaganda of previous generations. It spoke a language of freedom and democracy and dignity in ways that didn't come down to sort of like this gross socialist technocracy or the awful kind of like, oh well, you know, capitalism will eventually be a tide that raises all boats, but until we get there, you know, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. Which, of course, you know, for people in the so-called underdeveloped world, that's a lot of egg breaking you end up doing, and right, not much omelet eating. So the Zapatistas were just this incredibly bright revolutionary spark. And in terms of their roots, well, they are they're an indigenous movement that really has multiple root systems, one of which is the Mexican revolutionary tradition. Their name, Zapatista, is a intentionally chosen to honor the greatest, most unsullied, most authentic revolutionary hero of the Mexican Revolution from 1910 to 1917. That was Emiliano Zapata, who is the general of the Liberating Army of the South, and to this day regarded as kind of like to say he's like a Mexican Robin Hood doesn't do it justice. It's, you know, he's really this this figure who looms so large, and out of a revolution that was very, like so many, that was very compromised and ended up being very imperfect, he's the figure who most authentically really spoke out for grassroots democracy, for the right of peasants and non-elites to have a say over the way their lives were lived, and really tried to chart a course towards the kind of vision of autonomy, grassroots self-governance that we see in many movements today. So the Zapatistas, the modern-day Zapatistas, named themselves after him as a way of laying claim to the unfinished but authentic revolutionary struggle of the 1910s. And yeah, basically come out of this incredible crucible of really overwhelming state repression, especially in the far south of Mexico. And we're not just talking about, you know, sort of recent years, we're really talking about since the Mexican Revolution. So since the 1920s, the South has been, I mean, all of Mexico to some extent, like much of the global South, but the use of paramilitaries, hired guns, to say that the bureaucrats and civil officials are indifferent to the struggle of the poor or indigenous people really doesn't go far enough. Actively hostile, you know, prisons, like every mechanism in sort of mainstream society used to make sure that peasants, indigenous people, you know, any sector struggling to achieve social justice really like either had to fully bow down to the powers that be or was essentially wiped out. And so this incredibly difficult situation where people are organizing, being disappeared, being arrested, being put in prison, leads to a long period of above ground, very careful, very dignified, very public organizing, kind of, you know, what you might think of labor politics, protest politics. But through the beginning of the 1980s, it really becomes clear that peasants organizing for a better life for themselves and their families and communities aren't going to get anywhere by trying to ingratiate themselves to the state. And into this very difficult, very boilerpot matrix enters revolutionaries from the north of Mexico, from Mexico City, non-indigenous people, who have come there to radicalize the Indians, right? To radicalize the poor. And instead, they're very quickly met by people who are like, yeah, we're interested, but your revolutionary lingo, your coordinates of struggle, even your sense of who you are in history doesn't make any sense to us. So how about you come here, learn about the realities of this place, and then we'll talk. And to their great credit, this small group of urban revolutionaries do just that. They learn the languages of the indigenous people. They learn their history. They learn their customs, mythologies. And like out of this incredible moment, and I think it's hard to overstate the importance of this kind of like Marxist, revolutionary, modern set of ideals animating the revolution gets subordinated to the indigenous realities of the far southeast. And out of this, a brand new kind of struggle is born. And this is really what makes the Zapatistas to so many people so interesting, including me. And so this kind of segues nicely into my own history. So I was a young person growing up in southern Ontario, kind of like middle class by social position, but my parents struggled a lot in different ways economically, and we had brushes with, you know, racism, other kinds of forms of oppression. But living in the global north at the time as a middle class Canadian kid, it was hard to feel like you were one of the legitimately oppressed of the world, and it was hard to figure out where you could find coordinates, like feeling like you wanted something different than this version of sort of liberal capitalist society that was being fed to us at that time, and looking around for inspiration and just not finding it politically anywhere around me. And then, on January 1st, 1994, this revolutionary movement explodes out of nowhere, and seemingly out of nowhere. And, northern media channels are covering it nonstop. And I remember reading about it in the paper at the time and just being swept away, really, by the audacity, not knowing anything about like I was just a teenager about to go off to university. And so I had no real elaborate revolutionary knowledge at the time, but it just was so clear that these people were real, like authentic, you know, that they were deeply dignified in their struggle, that they didn't want to, you know, their conspicuous avoidance of civilian casualties in the first few days of the uprising was so remarkable and so different than what we'd seen in other places. And so like lots of other people, I was swept away in that. But really, it wasn't until I went off to university and then had the chance in different classes, you know, professors give you the opportunity to do a paper on something. And I was like, well, you know, I could do something easy and boring, or I could, you know, use these opportunities as ways of exploring something that I'm passionate about in the world. And I think notably, I'd be remiss in not adding that I was a huge fan of the band Rage Against the Machine at the time. And right. Zach De La Roca, the frontman of Rage Against the Machine, but the band as a whole, if anybody loves and remembers their second album, Evil Empire, that contains all kinds of songs about the Zapatistas on it. Rage became sort of like this, musical propaganda machine in the best sense for Zapatismo. Right. And again, I was, you know, I was swept away by it, by just the idea that it was possible to transform your world from the grassroots in a way that didn't mean that you were going to impose your version of what the future ought to be on everybody else, but that that was a struggle that we were going to make as we walked it together. I just think there's so much we can learn from that.
Yeah, that's interesting, that idea that music can be such a vehicle mm-hmm. for these kinds of revolutionary ideas.
Absolutely,
That's wonderful. Yeah. So I understand that the timing of the Zapatista National Liberation Army uprising on January 1st, 1994, wasn't chosen at random. It was also the day that the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, went into mm-hmm. effect. Can you talk about how the Zapatistas viewed NAFTA and what it meant for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So, much is made, and rightly so, of the date they chose to begin their uprising. So January 1st, 1994 was indeed the date that the North American Free Trade Agreement came into effect, binding Canada, the United States, and Mexico together at the time in the biggest free, so-called free trade zone in the world. And really, NAFTA, again, hard to remember now for most folks, but really, like, at the time was a template for the model of neoliberal capitalist globalization that would come to dominate, like, trade agreements from then on out, replacing an earlier model of capitalist development. And for a lot of people, that became a huge point of contention. Maybe folks remember the huge shutdown demos that went on in Seattle in 1999 against the World Trade Organization, where all kinds of folks came together. But that moment's not even possible without the Zapatista uprising in 1994, in part because the Zapatistas really are the spark that lights the fuse of that alter-globalization movement. But also because they do the hard work of very in very like inspiring but very straight ahead language of pointing out how these deals don't benefit ordinary folks, and in fact turn they don't like lead to this world that we were being sold at the time. Of, oh, it's going to be a wonderful cosmopolitan planet where everybody will be, you know, their own entrepreneur, and you're going to enter into this incredible marketplace of ideas. No, I mean, you know, and the Zapatistas have, one of their early documents that was released is a document called Chiapas, the Southeast in Two Winds, where their spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos at the time lays out exactly what it looks like to be on the ground in Chiapas. And he narrates his story of globalization as if it's a parasite, sucking resources and blood and, you know, like all these things that people need to live out of the state, out of the territory, feeding these arteries of global capitalism and leaving only death and disease and misery behind. That's not a reality that's very far from many people's minds today. I think, you know, a lot of this pushback against what we call capitalist globalization today, and even the right-wing reaction to it, has picked up on a lot of this. It really hasn't been a story of collective betterment. But at the time, you know, again, the Soviet Union had just fallen. This idea of globalization being this great cosmopolitan humanizing tide was something that people were eager to believe in, even if there was very little evidence for it. And the Zapatistas very cannily chose January 1st as the date of their uprising because they wanted to indict NAFTA. And indeed, their spokespeople said in the days after their uprising that NAFTA was a death sentence for indigenous peoples in Mexico. And the reason they said that was because as a criteria of Mexico entering into NAFTA with Canada and the US, they had to make critical changes to their constitution. And one of those changes was a change to Article 27, which is one of the most important revolutionary articles to emerge. So the Mexican Constitution is a product of the revolution. Comes It's made by the winners, essentially, after the revolution concluded in the 20s. And because the peasantry was really so critical in the Revolutionary War, and they were, you know, an armed peasantry, even after Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata are basically executed by the post-revolutionary state, they got to figure out what the powers that be have to figure out what to do with these peasants who are, like, you know, mobilized and armed. And so they say, okay, well, we'll give you one of your big demands, which is land reform. And so, you know, no surprise to anybody today, especially anybody in the global south, but obviously access to land is one of the most significant things for communities, especially for indigenous and peasant communities. And that was one of the most unequal things in Mexico. So you had all these big entities holding large parcels of land and increasingly less and less for communities themselves. So as a result of the revolution, the state comes in and says, okay, we'll redistribute land. And that is enshrined in Article 27 of the Constitution, that basically communities can petition the state for the right to own the land communally that their community sits upon. Now, this is never really instituted fairly or well at any point in Mexican history, but the fact that it exists is like this one kind of thread that keeps the hopes of people, of campesinos, of peasants, essentially, like agricultural workers alive, right? And in the lead up to NAFTA, Article 27 is basically struck from the Constitution and land reform ends. And it's at this point that the peasants are like, well, you know, if there's no reason for us to play by the rules, then how are we going to defend ourselves, our lives, and not just our individual lives, but our communal lives? And so this becomes one of the biggest sparks motivating the Zapatista uprising. So it's an indictment of sort of the corporate model of globalization, the corporate capitalist model, but it's more importantly, I think, an indictment of the specific transformations on the ground in Mexico and the communities the Zapatistas are coming from. And this is kind of like a theme that they will reiterate over their entire existence, which is that every legitimate revolutionary struggle emerges to address the conditions it faces in its own territory. And that means, like, what we want to build is not just one big umbrella struggle where one set of people, in this case, let's say indigenous peasants in Mexico, get to be the leaders of the whole thing, but that what we want is this network of struggles for humanity and against neoliberalism that will create this this world that is globalized, interconnected, but not reduced to any one group's agenda, desires, demands. And this becomes one of the central planks. And yeah, NAFTA is absolutely huge in catalyzing that. But again, I think, you know, one thing I would say is that for many observers in the global north, they made a lot of the NAFTA connection, and rightly so. But I think it's really important to note that there were many different grievances animating the Zapatistas. And while January 1st was chosen as a symbolic date, it also was meant to mark 500 years of resistance to colonization. So those two things overlap. And it's important, not, I think, for those of us who live outside of Mexico, not to simply say, oh, this is like the beginning of the movement against capitalist globalization, because it's also like more to do with the conditions on the ground, more to do with the history and the lived realities of those communities as they were experiencing them at the time, and as they were, you know, really confronting the reality that they wouldn't be able to exist as they did, even in the precarious conditions that they did at the time, if they didn't stand up for that right to live on territory that they collectively controlled.
Right. So, you know, yeah, many on the left are speculating now what we're seeing now is the, you know, the end of this neoliberalism, and we're seeing kind of a decline in that perhaps, but that remains to be seen, I guess.
Yep.
But
yeah,
can you talk a little bit more about you know, how the Mexican government responded to the Zapatista uprising in 1994 and why it initially agreed to negotiations?
It's a very important question, I think. So very predictably, in the first days after the new year, the Zapatistas rise up. They seize large parts of Chiapas. They seize several of the municipal seats, including the old colonial capital of San Cristobal de las Casas, which is significant for a lot of reasons, not least because it's a big tourist town. So all the tourists are there on January 1st, watching the revolution unfold.
Imagine.
And immediately the Mexican state responds, as anybody familiar with so-called counterinsurgency operations in the global south, like just pulling the page right out of the textbook. So they send in the military. And for all the talk about Mexico kind of being like on the cusp of a developed country, but, you know, a so-called developing country, their military is thoroughly first world and very closely linked to the U.S., obviously, trained and funded and all this kind of stuff. So they send in an absolute first world military and, you know, indiscriminately bomb villages who may or may not be affiliated with the Zapatistas, go house to house, carrying out summary executions, extrajudicial killings. They basically terrorize villagers, anybody they can find who they think might be a Zapatista. And the Zapatistas retreat very quickly. The insurgents retreat before this onslaught and sort of retreat back into the jungle and into the canyons where their bases are. And at this point, you know, to most observers, this is like literally just January 2nd, 3rd, 4th. It looks like this is going to follow the same script that we've seen elsewhere, where now it's just going to be this awful military occupation, that there's going to be a lot of collective punishment, and that, you know, there goes that moment, that opening. And surprisingly, I think because the Zapatistas don't have many, especially above ground connections to any element of Mexican civil society, they're no existing, you know, they weren't a public group beforehand. Nobody really knew about their existence, although lots of human rights workers and others on the ground in Chiapas through the 90s knew there was something cooking and like pressure building. But in the absence of any direct connections, in the absence of, you know, affiliations with political parties or trade unions, a huge portion of Mexican civil society sees the justness of the Zapatista uprising and really responds very spontaneously in the form of just gigantic public marches in solidarity with them in the days and weeks that followed the uprising. And the demands are very clear. The demands on the part of so many different Mexicans marching in the streets is that the government declare a unilateral ceasefire, that they sit down and negotiate with the Zapatistas. And that's basically the two main demands. So what's really incredible about this is, you know, just to put this in terms people can think about, right? Imagine like an insurgency exploding in your country where you don't have any direct connections. You're not sure of necessarily of the personal goodness of any of these people. But because of the way the revolution acts and presents itself, it's so clearly an uprising of really the most oppressed in Mexican society, and that's indigenous people. It's clearly an authentic and grassroots movement, and it's clearly calling not for violence and the seizure of power, but something many Mexican social movements had been fighting for decades, which is the realization of an authentic democracy in Mexico. So the response is overwhelming. You got marches of like a million people in Mexico City demanding the government and the counterinsurgency operations. And in the face of this, the government of Carlos Salinas at the time does just that. They pull their troops back and they say they're going to negotiate with the Zapatistas, which is really an incredible moment. Like, I think, you know, for those of us in the North, like, it's one thing to think about this, right? Because we live in a different political context. But in the global South, the idea that you would have an insurgency and it would be dealt with anything other than brutal military force is really impossible to think through. This is not at all similar to the Sandinistas or anybody else in the out of that sort of long legacy of revolutionary struggle, armed struggle in the global South. So as the Mexican historian Adolfo Gili has said, I think really eloquently, he says, you know, we need to remember that nobody negotiates because they recognize simply the humanity of the people that they're negotiating with. They negotiate because they're compelled to, right? And so it's the not just the force of arms, but the moral weight of the Zapatistas' call for justice that resonates with Mexican people and compels the government to do what it otherwise would never have done and to sit down and to try and carve out a negotiated settlement with the Zapatistas. And of course, it doesn't go that way. The negotiations aren't a waste of time, aren't just a dead end, but it doesn't end the struggle. It really doesn't solve the underlying issues, but it's still remarkable and significant at the time that happens. And yeah, the incredible inspiration and connections made by that moment of recognition between people who didn't really have much previous contact is remarkable.
Yeah, so that's kind of my next question is, what were the San Andres Accords, and, you know, were they ever honored?
Great question. So the San Andreas Accords were the first set of negotiations carried out by the Mexican federal government with the Zapatistas in the town of San Andreas in Chiapas. And they were about indigenous rights and autonomy. They were signed in 1997, but never actually implemented, at least not in the form that they were intended to be, because the government claimed that it couldn't get them passed. They couldn't get, you know, Congress to accept it. Whether that's true or not, whether the ruling class ever had any intention of doing that or just wanted to engage in the spectacle of negotiations, I think is an open question. But the accords are still really significant because the ones negotiated, for the Zapatistas anyway, they were very clear. They're like, our struggle is not about regional autonomy for indigenous people. Our struggle is a national struggle for democracy, justice, and liberty for all Mexicans. So one thing the Zapatistas were really clear about from the get-go is that, yes, they were indigenous, but they were also Mexican. They proudly flew the Mexican flag and saw themselves as the authentic inheritors of the nation alongside other Mexicans. And they had so when anarchists from the global north wanted to sort of project anarchism onto the Zapatistas, they were really clear. They're like, we're not anarchists, but you know, we respect your struggle and we respect the struggle of revolutionaries elsewhere. But yeah, the San Andreas Accords were a great example of them both getting the government to sit down and to agree to a set of principles that, had they been acted upon, would have been a really significant step towards both regional and indigenous communal autonomy within the scope of a modern nation state, which actually would have been super exciting for so many, you know, looking at whether it's the United States or Canada or New Zealand or Australia, where other significant indigenous struggles are occurring. This idea of, you know, how a modern nation state built out of settler colonialism could actually honorably learn to live alongside of original inhabitants of the territories, like, that's super exciting. And unfortunately, that was never realized. Of course, the Mexican state, as soon as it could, resorted to the old bag of counterinsurgency, and in part because this infamous memo that was leaked by the written by the Chase Manhattan Bank at the time, one of the largest financial banks in the world, but that, you know, had significant investments in Mexico and wrote to the Mexican government essentially saying, you need to demonstrate your control over your territory, otherwise investors won't like, they won't invest in you. They don't think their investments are secure. So, a lot of this was kind of linked to that memo. The memo never said eliminate the Zapatistas, but it essentially said you have to demonstrate forceful control. You know, you don't play around with property in this way. And so the accords at that time were essentially abandoned, and the government returned to so-called low-intensity warfare. Now, there were laws passed. There was a law passed later on in 2001, I believe, that was sort of like a hollowed out version of the San Andreas Accords that the Zapatistas and almost every other indigenous group in Mexico condemned as a step backwards in indigenous rights, actually, in the territory, which used a phrase like, indigenous communities are essentially public objects of concern, rather than, you know, so in it kind of infantilized them yet again, which is, you know, a double betrayal of the Accords in a lot of ways. But I think, you know, again, you know, 30 years later, it's easy to say, oh, well, those Accords, the great tragedy of them is that they weren't implemented. But I'd like to spin it the other way and say one of the most interesting things and important things about them is that they were negotiated in the first place. They stand as this historical and legal document that indicates that there are ways forward within the rubric of the modern nation state and all of its like bureaucratic awfulness that groups aiming for real liberation can actually achieve, and that there is a way of thinking about, you know, what we might call like a non-excluding modern world, right? Where like this question, and certainly in Canada, I know we wrestle with this a lot, like this whole question of like, what does multiculturalism in the modern state mean? Blah, blah, blah. Often that question is addressed really superficially. And it always still comes back to this idea in Canada of this absurd idea of two founding nations, the French and the English, right? And in Mexico, I think the importance of the San Andrés Accords really was to actually look at what building a society made up of many different people that could honor those different traditions and different aspirations might look like without creating a hierarchy of like political inequality amongst them. It was a really exciting moment, and I think that we should still see it that way, would be my argument. I think it's still an amazing testament to that, even though the state did what the state usually does, which is to protect vested interests, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. More of the same.
Yeah.
So the Zapatista movement still enjoys pretty considerable popular support. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, you know, have the various Mexican presidents since Carlos Salinas, how have they dealt with the movement? Was there any significant shift when Andrés Manuel López Obrador entered office?
I mean, I think there has been a bit of a shift. I think Obrador is certainly he comes from what we might call a left populist tradition. I think whether he's delivered on that, you know, is one of these contentious lefty points of argument, but maybe I won't go down that road. I think the Zapatistas since 2001, in many ways, since the end of the Institutional Revolutionary Party's 80-year dictatorship, which is essentially what they had. Different politicians, beginning with Fox in the early 2000s, have really tried different strategies, borrowing from, a grab bag of kind of like liberal, like attempts to conscript, demobilize, the Zapatista struggle through either negotiations or through trying to buy them off, through ignoring them, through effectively, ironically, and I think this is one of the things that people don't realize, kind of like letting them do their thing and hoping they'll go away, which is bizarre. But like, I mean, this is the thing that I think people should realize is that regardless of the legal recognition, the Zapatistas have effectively controlled somewhere around a third of the state of Chiapas for the last 30 years or so, without a legal recognition of autonomy, but a de facto one, and in fact have won over lots of people in communities around them who are not pro-Zapatista to begin with, simply because they run society better. Like their court system, their justice system works. They actually have development projects and open medical clinics that stay open. They are interested in educating, like all these things that the state had promised for years and years and years, but never delivered on. And then this revolutionary movement, without any resources from that state, managed to deliver these things in ways that made people's lives better. I think that was truly remarkable. Every once in a while, a president will get worked up about the Zapatistas, either, in Fox's famous cowboy-like persona, he promised he was going to resolve the conflict in 15 minutes. Well, that didn't happen. He and Zapatista spokespeople had this kind of famous back-and-forth banter. A lot of people focused on that, but I think, it's super important to acknowledge that once the PRI was out of the picture, the former ruling party, the Zapatistas, beginning in the early 2000s, made the decision to basically stop paying so much attention to the formal political scene and instead to just go about building those relations of autonomy on the ground. And so really it almost hasn't mattered to them as much the way that different political personalities have come through the presidential office. I think Obrador, a lot of people believed he was going to be better than previous presidents. The Zapatistas denounced him as well. In the lead up, they said, none of these people are ever going to be our saviors. They didn't, it wasn't really a thorough denunciation. But if you think that this system is going to lead to anything other than what we've seen, has been their fairly consistent response to that. So, the low-intensity warfare that was at its height in the late 90s up to the early 2000s, that is somewhat abated. that's a good news story, obviously. But, you know, I think it's probably fair to say that a broad-based policy of kind of like social neglect and hoping that the movement will burn itself out has been one of the major planks of governance ever since they learned they could not effectively eliminate the Zapatistas. They couldn't destroy them at the root. They couldn't uproot them. They couldn't buy people off. That there was too much rootedness in the social realities of the Southeast that they would never be able to get rid of them that way. Very typical strategy of kind of hoping that they'll become exhausted and defeated, lack of resources, all these kinds of things. And that has yet to happen, I think, really remarkably, and is a testament to the way they've built their movement, the way they have built like an intergenerational struggle that is self-sustaining now.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to see it, you know, and watching documentaries and so on there, you know, they're basically rebuilding society from the ground up in their own way. And that's, you know, it's, you know, this is just really interesting to see. So They are an armed movement. They have never surrendered their arms, is my understanding. So you kind of hinted at this before, but what kind of sets them apart from other revolutionary movements in Latin America, like, you know, Cuba, 1959, Nicaragua, 1979. Mm-hmm. What makes them different and enduring?
Yeah, very, very important question. So one of the things that sets them apart is their object of struggle, I guess I'd say, whereas in almost every previous leftist revolutionary movement, particularly in the Global South, but even elsewhere, the object of desire was always the state. It's like, if we can take the state, then, and its big old bureaucratic apparatus, we can transform the rest of society through it, right? So either, whether you're thinking about the, you know, the communist revolution in Russia, we're thinking about Mao's revolution, we're thinking about Cuba, we're thinking about the Sandinistas, we're thinking about the Shining Path. Like, ultimately, the goal is to unseat the existing ruling class and then, in a fairly top-down way, transform society from the top down. And the Zapatistas offered a very different vision of struggle, arguably one that, you know, like if... I mean, it's fair to say that if you read their declaration of war, which is the first declaration of the Lacandon jungle, which is issued on January 1st, 1994, that statement reads like a lot closer to a lot of this sort of familiar history. Although I'd still point out, because people will, you know, they sort of like, the detractors will say that the Zapatistas were savvy and quickly realized after January 1st that they weren't going to be able to actually enact their revolution. They weren't going to be able to make it to Mexico City. The army was simply too well-resourced, too well-trained, that they weren't going to be able to... So then they backtracked and decided. And I think that's a very unfair reading of the movement. It ignores its history. It ignores the struggles that went on within the Zapatista movement in order to build it into the thing it became. But importantly, it also ignores the fact that embedded in that first declaration are all the hallmarks of their struggle going forward. So they identify what they're after, and the items on their list are not political power. They're things like land, healthcare, peace, justice, education. So their list is revolutionary and modernist in that sense. So a lot of others would agree with that. But on the other hand, it totally ignores the seizure of state power and the idea that they're going to implement the revolution on behalf of everybody else. I'd say the second thing is their emphasis on democracy. So rather, again, than thinking about, okay, we're going to have a dictatorship of the revolution until we're ready to move forward, which is effectively what, you know, that's what Cuba is. I'm not trying to cast aspersions on the Cuban Revolution, super important revolutionary struggle. But at the same time, you know, we do have this sort of revolutionary interregnum in most of these struggles where it's like, okay, then the revolutionary bosses take over and you got to listen to them and nobody deviates from that. And then when we're ready, we'll become like a democratic society. And of course, unsurprisingly, that moment when the new elites give up power never seems to arrive, right? So the Zapatistas were very clear about that at no point did they want to seize that power. They did want to unseat the existing illegitimate power holders, but then immediately open up up a space for democratic processes like that were real and authentic and that involved all Mexicans. And the third thing I'd say about that is that they quickly speak a language that has that departs so dramatically from the revolutionary bureaucraties of previous revolutionary struggles. So, I mean, people will talk up Marcos's writings in this way a lot, and certainly he's a beautiful writer and spokesperson, but it really, like, it weaves its way through so many of the Zapatistas' communications with both national and international civil society, where they write revolutionary stories based in the indigenous cosmology of their territory. So in these incredible kind of open-ended, like, revolutionary mythical stories about you know, about spirits of ancestors or indigenous gods or animals or revolutionary figures of the past imagined as having. So, like, you get this incredible, playful, open-ended discourse that is really meant to invite other people who also feel like their lives are up against those cutting edges of the status quo, and they don't have any dignity, they don't have any choice, they don't have any, you know, self-determination in their lives. So it's a really famous communique that Marcos writes where there's one point where the Mexican government thinks they've figured out who he really is, right? How, like, who his true identity is. And rather than responding and saying, you got it wrong or whatever, the Zapatistas respond in what will become like a hallmark of their style and say, actually, Marcos is gay. He's a woman. He's a worker. He's a, you know, he's a trash collector on the subway. He's an unemployed teacher. And they basically go through and list all these subordinated positions in society and says, like, if you are somewhere, your humanity is being denied, and you decide that what you're going to do is struggle to reclaim it, then you too are a Zapatista, and you can also be Marcos. Anybody can put on the mask and say, I am Marcos. And in that moment, I think, like, it's an invitation to this open-ended and primarily nonviolent struggle. I mean, this is the interesting thing that I think the Zapatistas do, this beautiful dance, as you've talked about, right? Like, they to this day remain a movement in arms because they're aware that, like, if they say they're going to lay down their arms, then they open themselves up to this incredible repression again. And so they refuse that. They've learned the lessons of revolutionary history in that sense. But at the same time, they, like, since the early days of 94, the Zapatistas have not fired a single offensive shot against the Mexican military. They have at points had to use their weapons in a defensive fashion, but really even then it's been so limited. And their primary planks of struggle have been this attempt to build a broad-based, above-ground, nonviolent but radical movement for justice, dignity, liberty, and democracy. And really, like, that's become the basis of their struggle. And it just, you know, I think it spoke to so many people who were desperately tired, first of all, of the endless cycle of insurgency and counterinsurgency all across the global south, which of course has resulted in nothing but these, like, atrocities and mass graves and, you know, all of this, and no betterment in society, but also people who were, like, really cynical about being just invited and conscripted back into the status quo, who felt, well, okay, like, I don't want to pick up a gun and go to war, but on the other hand, I don't want to simply be told that I'm going to go and cast my vote for the same set of ruling class functionaries, and it's not going to get me anywhere. There's got to be something other than that. And the Zapatistas really provided revolutionary horizon towards which we can struggle, where we're not sacrificing those aspirations, but we're also acknowledging that violence can't be the way we build the world we want, because it will always retain the characteristics of, like, of the tools we use to bring it into being. So, yeah, it's this really unusual dance. I mean, compare it to the Shining Path in Peru, leaving, like, you know, dead dogs strung up in trees and these kinds of things as a way of terrorizing villagers into complicity, or, you know, or bureaucratic revolutions elsewhere that really use this dry, dusty Marxist-Leninist language. I mean, the Zapatistas learned all of those lessons. Like, I mean, Marcos and others, the urban revolutionaries, were obviously well-schooled in In a whole bunch of revolutionary ideologies, Marxism not least among them. But it's that story that I think we need to take super seriously of them going to the South essentially as urban revolutionaries and just confronting the reality, the indigenous realities of the far Southeast, and being transformed by them and being welcomed into those communities after that transformation occurs. As non-Indigenous people, but as people who are seen as comrades in the struggle. So, like, you have all these things that trouble, like, so much of the nonsense politics we have amongst on the left today around, you know, facile notions of identity or any of these things, or even, like, sort of celebrating really like formal elements, like, oh, we have to make every decision by consensus or something in order to. The Zapatistas have always said that, like, it's not about hanging our hats on a single kind of way of doing things. What it is, it's about acknowledging that the struggle is always one that's being renewed from the grassroots. And they talk about how the struggle is more powerful now than it was 30 years ago, because the people who are at the forefront are now the kids who were born into that struggle, right, and have grown up within that context. So, right, I think that's a love. That's an amazing. It's not like, oh, Lenin. It's not like, oh, Che Guevara. It's not looking, right, back to Marcos and saying, oh, that was our great revolutionary hero. We're trying to live up to him. It's like, no, actually, the generations coming of age now are the vanguard of the revolution, precisely because they're the ones who have been raised within it. And I think that's a beautiful message.
Yeah, yeah. So going back to this collective, mm-hmm, liberation, it's not about any individual figure. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, governments typically want to, like, okay, find the leader, take them
totally
out. You know?
Exactly, right?
Yep. Yeah. So can you provide some sort of a framework in talking about whether or not the Zapatismo has succeeded or failed, or, you know, how do we understand that?
Yeah, this is a classic. This is, as a social movement scholar, like, I appreciate this question so much. And I think it is an important one for sure. I think people get hung up on measures of success and failure, particularly in liberal democracies, in a way that often ends up just coming down to a narrow accounting of, like, oh, how many seats do you have in parliament, in Congress, in the Senate, whatever, like, who's in the presidency. I mean, one of the lessons the Zapatistas tried to teach us very vigorously in the 90s was that it doesn't matter, like, which personality is sitting in the driver's seat. The fact is the whole infrastructure remains the same, right? And if the whole infrastructure remains the same, we'll never have any better say in that. So, I mean, I think in that way, it frustrated a lot of people. And to the same degree that I talked about before, about their use of violence or their disavowal of the desire to seize power. I mean, a lot of people, and I think a lot of people who were allies too and continue to be allies, were sort of cynical about that and said, oh, well, look at Venezuela. Look at what Chavez is achieving, you know, under a much more sort of typical socialist top-down revolutionary intent, right? Like, use oil revenue, seize the state, defend the state. And people got excited about that in the way that outsiders often get excited about any struggle they're not a part of. They're like, look, it's further along. Isn't that so impressive? Shouldn't we now replicate that model? But look at Venezuela now and look at the far southeast of Mexico, right? And after Chavez's very suspicious and untimely death, like, I think, you know, you have the exactly what the Zapatistas, like what we were just talking about, the cutting off of the head of a movement, it's disillusion after that. And even if the struggle continues, it continues in this incredibly impoverished way. And Zapatistas have always been super clear about that. They're like, we're not trying to get somewhere and then it's done. This is a struggle for collective liberation that we literally are just going to walk every single day of our lives, never arrive at that final point. There's something, I think, incredibly humble, human, and beautiful about that sentiment that most revolutionary movements forget, that it's not about just achieving the defeat of the enemy. It's also about acknowledging that in order to make a new society, you actually have to make new social relations, new institutions, new ways of relating to each each other and even seeing who we are, because that's how a revolution endures. It doesn't endure by creating new laws and having people follow them. Those laws can always be changed. But if you change the way that people see themselves in the world and the systems they're a part of, in that way, I think Zapatismo is a total success. It's amazing. And when it's been a long time since I've been to Zapatista territory physically, but when I was there in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, it was an incredible it was completely banal, I'll say, but also incredibly heartwarming and inspiring to be like you driving down the road, right? It's just it's a highway, and you pass a sign that says in Spanish, "Welcome to territory in rebellion, everything for everyone, nothing for ourselves," and then it says like no drugs, no guns, underneath all this kind of stuff, right. And then you enter into Zapatista territory, and you're like, you know, you go to a village. I went to Oventique, one of the five centers of good governance in Zapatista territory. And you're met by ordinary humans, some of whom are wearing balaclavas, many of whom are not. It's a village, it's a town. It's like people are going about their daily lives. They're making textiles, they're growing coffee, they have a communication center, they have a place where they make food and sell it to visit. Like, it's just, this is what real life looks like in a place that is not trying to build a scene or a spectacle or a moment, but is actually trying to build over the long term deep roots of a different way of being in the world. In many ways, based on tradition. This is the thing that people think, oh, they're indigenous, they want to just go back to. But this is like a super important point. The communities that the Zapatista struggle emerge out of in the 50s in Mexico, they're actually not the traditional indigenous communities. They're not the places that have existed for decades and even a century. They're these communities essentially of exiles, refugees, people who can't find land elsewhere and come together in the jungle and in the canyons, find each other and are forced to grapple with that reality. So they're, in some ways, they're doing what many indigenous scholars in the North talk about today, they're calling it self-conscious traditionalism, where they're looking back for signposts, for ways of orienting themselves, but they're resolutely looking forward. They're not just trying to reinvent the past. They're like, this is how, you know, this is what makes us us, but how can we take this principle and reinvent it for a modern world, right? So their focus on diversity and autonomy, for example, these kinds of things. So like, as a movement that has actually succeeded in controlling its territory and building a new way of being in the world, it's been an absolute success. And I think one of the few enduring examples of that struggle towards autonomy in a world that's very hostile to it. If you want to measure it on the basis of more conventional revolutionary metrics of success, and this is where the grumpy Marxist-Leninists will always yell at me and say, but they still don't control the state, or they still don't, you know, well, yeah, that's true, you know, and they are still, there's no doubt, I'm not trying to paint an unnecessarily rosy picture. Life is hard. There is no, you know, they haven't somehow arrived at a place where they don't have to worry about violence directed against them, or you know, they're not totally economically secure, obviously. Like, life is hard without any of the resources the state might provide to, like, build schools or get goods to market or build a hospital or whatever. And yet, 30 years later, there they are. And I think one of the incredible metrics of their success is, yeah, when you go through areas in Chiapas where people were not, They weren't original Zapatistas, and they may not even call themselves that now, but they essentially are living life on Zapatista territory because they're making use of all those institutions, because they would just work better than the state does. You know, they're fairer, they're more just, they're more transparent, they're actually available. And I think what an awesome lesson for Northern radicals and revolutionaries to learn. Because so much of our activism is based around the creation of scenes and really quite exclusionary ones, where often if you don't speak the right language, you don't know the right revolutionary ideologies, or you don't present yourself in particular kinds of ways, you're really not welcome. And they tend to be ephemeral and short-lived. And I think rather than that, thinking about how one builds a movement that has deep roots, that is always predicated on recognizing the humanity of other people in struggle, and often like has to take the time to have really difficult, sometimes difficult to resolve conversations about how we're doing what we're doing, where we're going, and what we're building towards, but all in the context of a life that you're building together, you know, not just some like I'm running away and looking for a lifeboat, but that we are standing right where we are and building the alternative that we know we need to survive in this world. And we hope that in setting that dignified example that other people will want to join in too. And I think that's, I mean, I just wish in this moment where, you know, a far-right populism is really like making a lot of hay out of the global inequalities we're dealing with, that you know, people on the left would return to that too, that notion of like building a dignified common sense struggle on the ground that makes sense to people because it helps them meet their needs right there. I mean, really, I think that's the best current account I could give of the Zapatistas. And I think while it's not the kind of like sexy and then the bad guy was defeated and then we had everything we wanted, it's really like in our world, probably the best outcome for a revolutionary struggle we could ever imagine. And what a testament 30 years later, you know, to be still standing your ground and defending that dignified autonomy.
Right, right. Alex, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about your books on the Zapatistas. The first is called Zapatismo Beyond Borders. It was published in 2008 by the University of Toronto Press. And the second, Zapatistas, published 2 years later by Zed Books. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what's covered in these two books and why you wanted to write those?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the first book, Zapatismo Beyond Borders, really like... It came out of my scholarly interest in people like me, because as I was saying before, right, like my undergrad, I spent every opportunity I could like writing papers or learning about the Zapatistas and similar kinds of struggles. When I finally decided to do grad school, I you know, I was equally interested in them. My master's was about that. I looked at the connection between independent labor in Mexico and the Zapatista struggle, and that was super rewarding, interesting, and fulfilling because those, the connection between labor and indigenous struggles in the global north is something that often doesn't make sense. Often those groups find themselves at opposed to one another. But when it came time to do my PhD, I was really torn. I was, as somebody trained in anthropology, I have this deep and overriding anxiety about telling other people's stories for them when they don't need a gringo like me dropping into their community and telling those stories. They're Mexican anthropologists, historians, even Zapatistas, obviously, who were telling that story better. So I was really, I found myself like in a bit of an existential crisis. I'm like, I don't want to just tell a story about a movement that seems exotic and go in, drop in for a year, even if that, on the ground there, and then come back and tell this story to Canadian kids like me who are looking for inspiration. And then it just struck me, I'm like, well, why don't I look at the way that Zapatismo as a political philosophy and practice that's grown out of this incredible movement has and continues to circle the globe, the channels that it uses to do so, the effects it produces, and the activist groups who are picking it up elsewhere and explicitly acknowledging their solidarity with the Zapatistas and inspiration by them, but who are actually trying to ground it in their circumstances of struggle. And so I spent a couple of years traveling across Canada and the States, interviewing a bunch of different activists who had been inspired, like me, by the Zapatistas. Some worked in very conventional NGOs. Some of them worked in radical filmmaking collectives. Some of them worked in, you know, indigenous grassroots solidarity or labor movements or whatever. But that book is really about how political imaginations travel, why they travel, what people are hoping for when they link their sense of possibility to someone else's struggle on the ground. And I didn't want to deny that a lot of this can have like really problematic overtones, like that tendency to romanticize, to exoticize, to commodify and consume other people's struggles is so crummy in so many cases, even right. When it's understandable. Right. But I also thought there was a lot of commentary at the time, right, in the early 2000s about how that was the character of much of the solidarity with the Zapatistas. And I really disagreed with that. So just from my own experience, so that book was an attempt to make sense of that and to see how this imagination was traveling and sparking meaningful social change activity elsewhere on its own terms and in its own context. And that second book that I wrote was a much more sort of popular introduction to the Zapatistas. It's part of Zed's Rebel series at the time, so I was really happy to write it. But for me, that was a really interesting project too, because it allowed me to hone in on the Zapatistas as this kind of like global revolutionary movement, and to look at their roots in Chiapas, but also their connection then to the cycle of struggles that was happening kind of on a global scale, that were taking neoliberal capitalism and the dynamics of globalization at the time as their target, and how they were achieving that or not. And so, yeah, thinking about the Zapatistas as examples of this spirit of rebellion, of the like a manifestation of this kind of trans-historical rebel spirit that we see in every society at different times, when ways of being kind of like become intolerable for ordinary folks because the world isn't going to let them live the lives that they thought they were going to be able to, and what do they do in those conditions? So it was a great honor to write those books, and I really loved like that process. Is not about me, but in many ways, when I look back on it now, it's I certainly learned much more from the Zapatistas than either of those books can fairly convey. But that's like a super important part of my own revolutionary thinking, radical thinking, and it was a real pleasure to have the chance to write them.
Yeah. So I'll leave a link to those books.
Oh, and awesome.
In addition to your more recent work as well. I'd like to conclude with your thoughts on the future of Zapatismo and, I guess, you know, radical social movements more broadly.
Yeah. We are currently living through that moment, living up to that cliched Chinese proverb that we are living through very, very interesting times. And I think it's funny because as a social movement scholar, I definitely get this question a lot. You know, people, not this question, but questions about, oh, what's going to happen next? How do we know? And I always say, you know, as academics, we're great at diagnosis and deconstruction and terrible at prediction. So predicting is not something we do well. At the same time, I think, you know, we're at a moment where almost all those options are in play again, in a way that in moments in history when, you know, the ruling class seems stable and the status quo seems fairly well watered and fed, you know, people struggle to find the inspiration for their ideas of how life might be different. But right now it seems so easy. So many people are so dissatisfied in so many parts of the world. I was just reading an article, I think, in the New York Times yesterday about this new rhetoric in the UK about the slogan "Broken Britain," right? People talking about, and so like think about this in 2023, we're living through a moment where all across, like some of the most overdeveloped, richest, most powerful nations on the planet are in the midst of a broad-based crisis of legitimacy, of democratic, our democratic institutions have been undermined and radically called into question, where we see the digital networks that we were promised that would be our highways to a global communication, you know, Shangri-La, have instead become feeding tubes for every conspiracy theory. And I think within this, like, I mean, people are just so desperate for inspiration, for visions of alternatives. And I'm not even going to debase the right-wing populist response to this. While it's not my vision of transformation, I think we are remiss in dismissing it as some like critics on the left have. I don't think it's not hopeful, it's not humane, it's not dignified or good. But the one thing I'll give them credit for right now is that they are speaking powerfully back in ways that are clearly resonating with people against this kind of neoliberal technocracy, right? And that's resonating with people. So I think movements like the Zapatistas, I think, are now more urgently needed than ever, really. It's, I think, a wonderful thing that you're doing this episode right now on this issue, because I would love for people to think about this right now and to look. I mean, social movement struggle is a wonderful repository for these kinds of things. And I would encourage, like, if you're feeling lost right now, read about some of the really amazing struggles for collective liberation that have checkered our past, right? And even in places like the States or Canada, we have lots of movements like these, right, that kind of like emerge from the same spirit as the Zapatistas that have been intentionally covered over and forgotten and left out of our kind of authorized histories because, yeah, the ruling class doesn't want you to know that by joining forces with other people who are up against those cutting edges, that you too can be powerful and you too can remake your world. They would rather have you believe that you have to invest in demagogues or in the status quo in order to make any change. And I think that the enduring legacy of the Zapatistas is still that humble people acting from where they are situated can make a huge difference in the world and transform their lives and the lives of others in a way that make our world more connected, more humane, less violent, more democratic, more dignified, that they can like bring into being a real relation between peoples based on autonomy that is mutual and not exclusionary. So not about this, oh, it's my right not to wear a mask and fuck you, but instead this mutual recognition of dignity and of difference amongst the destinations that we're choosing for ourselves, right? That there might be a way forward that we can find that doesn't involve just buying into one person's or one party's vision of what the future has to be, that can be much more open-ended. And I think those are such important lessons. I mean, the Zapatistas today continue to do exactly what they've done since that first day of 1994, which is to defend, well, maybe I'll reverse it, to build and defend those actual, like, living examples of alternatives. And I can't say enough about that. I think once you go to work, once we leave our, you know, our social media cesspools and our individual kind of like either fantasies or nightmares of what's going on right now and what's going to come out of it, and you commit to going to do something with people around you who you find common cause with and in a spirit of building humane, dignified, and decent alternatives, like just you coming together with a few of your neighbors or coworkers or peers, like wherever you find yourself, begins to like cultivate that spirit. And that's one of the lessons that I think the left in the North forgets most often. Like, we're fascinated by the Zapatistas' media presence. We're fascinated by their iconography. We're fascinated by the revolutionary sort of ritual of, and that's all cool. Like, I get all of that. Don't get me wrong. But most of that can in no way be imported easily to the global North, right? Like, the context is totally different. We're not going to start like a revolutionary movement that looks just like an armed insurgency in the southeast of Mexico in Halifax, right? But if I take the best lessons, that it means concretely building relations amongst people who don't always see common cause in terms of who they are, but that we begin with that principle that alternatives is something that comes from the grassroots and not from the top down, that what we're trying to do is not create a vast like sort of map of sameness, but recognize difference amongst our struggles, communities, identities, and then build towards a way of like working towards a space in common that we can all live together. Like, those things become so possible in a way that abstract discussions and debates over tactics or ideology or whatever just don't get us there. So for me, I think the Zapatistas will be here for another 30 years easily, right? I'm not trying to look through my very imperfect social movement crystal ball, but when I say that, but I think, you know, the work they've done simply isn't going to be washed away in any kind of way right now. And in fact, like, we can see that as a real example of alternative building that's durable and meaningful. And for the rest of us, yeah, I would say let's return to that notion of building the struggle where we're at, learning the best lessons from struggles like the Zapatistas, which again are not about copying them, but much more about embodying that spirit, right, of connection, this kind of like commitment to endless, sometimes very difficult conversations with each other. And I don't mean just purely like conversational, but actually working with people who you don't always like, you know, who aren't just sort of cookie cutter example of you or what you imagine the world to be like, but challenge you to think about what this sort of diverse, dignified life would look like. And then, yeah, just to begin in very partial and imperfect ways to work towards that. You know, it's never going to be finished. It's always going to be a journey we're on. But if we're committed to that, then at least you won't end up in a space where you're like, oh yeah, it seems like a great idea for a whites-only nation in the northwest of America somewhere where we're going to create our utopia and drive everybody else out. That becomes a lot less likely than that spirit of, yeah, we're all being ground up. Let's find a way to get past this together and to chart a new course at a time when those possibilities are really richly alive again. I'd say that's one of the exciting things about right now. And like, people feel down a lot of the time, stressed, anxious about our political context. But man, the ruling class has really demonstrated that it is both incompetent and disinterested in managing this particular version of making the rest of us work for them. So let's use that disinterest and that incompetence to carve out really meaningful alternatives. And we got to get to work doing that. And it begins with some of that boring person-to-person work of figuring out how we're going to live together.
Right. Amen. Well, I think we can all draw some inspiration from the Zapatista movement and find ways to apply it to our own movements, our own personal growth. And I'd love to talk about this for the rest of the day, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Alex Kaznabish, thank you so much for your time. It was such a wonderful to speak to you today.
Oh, thanks, Jason. I had a great conversation too. Thanks for the invitation to be here and to to talk to your listeners. It was wonderful.
You can find Alex's published works and media appearances on alexkaznabish.com. Look for the link in the show notes. Curious Naked Diatribes is part of the Javi Media Network, on the web at javimedia.net. Send email to info@javimedia.net. Javi Media.